Hello.
Hello. I tried to time it right.
Yeah, it was timed perfectly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How are you?
I'm all right.
All right? Just all right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, all right?
I have a drink.
Oh, that's nice. What is the bev?
You know what the bev is.
Is it a, what is it? Two fingers of McNurse things?
It is two fingers. It's not Michter's. It is whatever this slightly cheaper Glenlivet they started selling is. It's actually pretty good. It's got a blue label. It's called like Founder's Reserve or some crap. It's only like $30 or something, but it's actually surprisingly decent average Scotch.
Decently average.
Well, I first had it when we last went to Italy. All of the various lounges that had alcohol just had bottles of this everywhere, and I was like, you just got Glenlivet hanging out like in your airport lounge, like, don't mind if I do. I don't care if it's 2 in the afternoon here. It's it's 5 o'clock somewhere in my jet lag brain, so I just drank a bunch of free whiskey wherever we stopped for things, and I enjoyed it, so I bought some when I saw it here.
Okay, well, that's good.
It's tasty. It's tasty. I also have some seltzer here, as yeah. I do.
I have a High Lie beer.
A High Lie beer. This is the one you had last time.
Yes, Cigar City Brewing Company from Tampa, Florida. The one that's owned by the son of the strip club magnate.
Hang on. Let's back up for a second. Did you say it's a what beer? A varsity beer?
High Lie.
Right, but then after that you said it's a something beer.
Cigar City Brewing.
Cigar City. I think it's varsity, like it had finally made first team All-American or something.
No. Well, is there a varsity highlight? I wouldn't even know.
It's got to be. If there's high school highlight, there's got to be varsity and junior varsity.
Is there high school highlight?
I don't know. Let's see. Google high school high. I always spell highlight wrong.
They should spell that. J-A-I-G-H school. Get it?
What?
Anyway, never mind. But yes, it is a beer. They have it at the BevMo, so I partake. Reminds me of better craft beers that you can get in Tampa, even though Tampa sucks. But that's just something I think about. On occasion.
Tampa.
Yeah, Tampa. I'm going back next week for the President's Day weekend.
That's very exciting. Is there an occasion besides President's weekend?
No, I didn't see my family a lot last year, and some family members are getting older, so I would like to see them more.
As one does, yes.
Yeah, but it's going to be a lot of fun, because I get to fly into Orlando and then drive to Tampa and then drive back to Orlando and then fly
like,
out of Orlando.
You can take the scenic route. You can see the sights.
Yeah, I really hate going in and out of Orlando. As many people do, but the problem is that there are just more direct flights to Orlando because there are people who like to go to theme parks. It just so happens, unfortunately. Not a lot of people want to go to Tampa, even though it has theme parks, because its theme parks are Busch Gardens, and Adventure Island.
I've been to a Busch Gardens. Isn't there a Busch Gardens in California?
No. There's the Busch Gardens in Tampa, Florida, and there's a Busch Gardens in Williamsburg, Virginia.
Well, maybe I went to the Florida one. I don't know.
You may have gone to a Six Flags, which...
No, I've been to a Six Flags. I've been to a Knott's Berry Farm. I've been to the various other things. I'm relatively certain I have been to a Busch Gardens.
Well, then, I don't know what you visited out in California. But there's the Busch Gardens. Or you can work at the Florida Aquarium, as I did, and have people show up and ask you when they can see Shamu. And you have to inform them that the Florida Aquarium is not SeaWorld. SeaWorld is, in fact, in Orlando, where SeaWorld is. But that doesn't still happen in an age where everyone could use Google. But that's just the kind of thing you can look forward to if you work at the Florida Aquarium.
I feel like Florida probably has one of the higher percentages of flip phones in the nation.
That is probably true. A lot of jitterbugs.
What's that one brand of phone that that specifically markets their phones to old people? It has like giant buttons and stuff.
Jitterbug.
You know what I'm talking about?
Jitterbug. The thing I said.
Well, there's another one then. are multiple. It's a competitive market. The old people cell phone. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Jitterbug.
Jitterbug.
It's a dance from a bygone era.
Mm-hmm.
An era where people wore suits and hats and rode around in old-timey vehicles and or horses.
Yeah, I was going to say horseback. So a couple months ago, I saw an amazing clip, a little snippet of the Phantom movie posted onto Twitter by a former coworker, and it had reminded me how genuinely awful that movie is and how I had seen it when it first came out because there was press about it being something like a superhero thing to see. And it turns out it was awful then. And it just hasn't improved with age, but there are just some really spectacular moments. And in particular in this tweet that was, that I came across, it highlights, James Remar's delivery of dialogue that, is just so stilted and weird. And the framing of the action is so bad and the choreography is awful. And the writing is just, you couldn't write it any worse than is written, for those scenes. But anyway,
although amazingly, the writer on this movie has written some good things,
which I don't know how that happened. Maybe he like wrote this and was like, I give up. And just like turned it in, and he's like, just send me a check. Like, it's a silly Sunday morning comic. I don't want to deal with it. Although it is not just Sunday mornings; it is also a weekday comic. But
is this a newspaper comic?
Yes,
Adventure comic strip. Look at that.
Yeah.
Huh.
Is it a newspaper comic? It's by King Features, and that's owned by Hearst. You can't get any more newspaper than Hearst. they had licensed this to Paramount to make a superhero movie out of. As we have discussed beforehand, he is not technically a superhero. He has no like powers per se, although it's debatable if the delusion of his father is a ghost or like just his brain from living in a cave, drinking cave water.
Well, we know he has a magic ring, but yeah, basically the way that I like to think about it, as I mentioned to you, is that he is Batman mixed with the Dread Pirate Roberts, because he lives in a cave named after, well, a human, I guess, so it's a skull cave, and he doesn't have superpowers. He also doesn't really wear like cool protective gear like Batman, but he has purple spandex suit, but he's like the Dread Pirate Roberts in that the you know, there's a myth that he's immortal. The Phantom has existed for 400 years, but really it's just that every time one of them gets like stabbed, they die, and then like their kid picks up the mantle. Although it's kind of amazing to me that James Remar killed the Phantom, or what's his name?
Patrick McGoohan.
Yeah, sure. He killed the dad, and then now he's fighting Billy Zane. And he's like, it can't be. You can't be alive. I killed you. It's like, you didn't notice that the guy you're fighting now happens to be like 40 years younger than the other one that you killed? Whatever, fine. Maybe it's just been like a couple of decades since you killed the other one that you don't really remember. But it's all right. Whatever.
James Remar does not demonstrate a lot of critical thinking in this movie.
Yeah, you know, you cover up somebody's eye-ish region and their hair and put him in like a competitive speed figure skating suit, and then you just can't really tell who they are anymore.
No. And also put some
black. He really does look like he's going for gold at the Winter Olympics, doesn't he?
What I really like about it is the black eye polish stuff underneath around the eyes.
Yes. And you can see in all of the close-ups.
And then he takes it off at the end, and it's just magically gone.
Uh-huh. Cut to the wide angle, so we can't tell that we had to do a thing there where we cleaned all the makeup off of his face.
So silly. Yeah, and he's got a very... It's not just that it's a purple spandex suit, it's that it's also... It's a little flamboyant, a little Joel Schumacher, I would say.
It's got some cool patterns on it. It's got some, I don't know, like shapes and designs. It's probably...
It's a skull.
Well, I mean, there's like swoopy bits that's probably supposed to be sort of like indigenous iconography or something, but...
He has an affliction bodysuit. It is just silly looking.
It's like if you took the a bunch of like Walmart grade Punisher t-shirts and turned them into a full body purple spandex suit.
Oh yeah, and he's got that belt buckle. It's like he just won a WWE match or something. I don't know what that is. But there is nothing. What's really weird is like the Phantom inspires like a ghostly presence. There's nothing stealthy or ghostly about his presence. Like he's
right, the first time the bad guys see him, they're like, ah, it's some thing on a horse. It's like, no, it's a dude in a suit. Like there's nothing in this that would make you think it's anything other than a dude in a suit.
Not a thing. Especially in broad daylight. It is amazing to me how much of this movie takes place in broad daylight. We're just like, is this foreboding for anyone? Like, we're in the jungle in broad daylight and he's on a white horse jumping over a log in slow motion. Like, oh no, it's something on a horse. And it's like, no, it's really like 100% clear that it's a guy in purple spandex on a white horse jumping over a log. Like it could not be more clear. They wrote it as if it was some obscure thing that you could barely tell who it was. And it's like, that's not how this was shot. I'm not sure if that is just Simon Winsor's fault or like who?
I mean, there's probably production concerns because it's cheaper to shoot in the daytime.
Yeah, but still
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You could it, like day for night or something. Like there is no mystery here. Like it is 100% obvious what is happening in every moment of this, which doesn't help when the action choreography is so stilted and student project level. So you can see when people are like doing a stage punch and pausing, they don't cut away or anything. And then you can just watch them hold in place while somebody else grabs their fist and twists it around. And then they go through with the next move. And it's just like, this is like a slow motion ballet dance. Like you guys, you can't move so slow and deliberately. And like, you gotta like fix it in editing. You gotta shoot around that so you don't see
it up a little bit or something.
Yeah, like there's a scene early on in this where Christy Swanson's character, unfortunately Christy Swanson, whom I forgot was even in this, she punches Catherine Zeta-Jones and she does it in the stagiest stage punch ever, where it's just like this big, broad, arcing, you know, slow punch, and then Catherine Zeta-Jones is knocked back and falls over. And it's not that she's knocked back. She is pulled downwards onto what I assume was a blanket or mat underneath her, while Christy Swanson continues her arcing, definitely didn't hit anything punch. It is absurd looking. And the whole movie is like that. All the action scenes, especially the climactic final action scene where it's supposed to be the biggest stakes in the world, but it is...
It's literally the worst.
It is the Pirates of the Caribbean ride, and the people move like they're the animatronics on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. It's all super overlit on a stage, and they're just swinging at each other in slow motion. Some people
the
have...
The ground is all very clearly that sort of like poured concrete that they've kind of painted to look like rocks or whatever from all of the Disneyland rides.
Yeah, and when people knock into things, they're made out of foam. There is a shot where James Remar is knocked into a stone column. Like it's supposed to look like it's stones that are put one on top of each other with mortar in between, and the whole thing bends because obviously it wasn't actually made out of stone in any way. So it's just 2 feet from the camera. You didn't cut away from it.
Well, see, nowadays you could fix that. You freeze frame it before the shake, and then you freeze frame it after the shake, and you do a little bit of a warp and a morph between the two. I've had to do that.
Oh yeah, me too. It's not to say that people don't shoot garbage these days. It's just a little surprising that it was not obvious to the people who are making this that they were shooting garbage at the time. They didn't know that they had a budget where they could just fix things later by like planar tracking and stabilizing things. Like that was not in their budget when they were doing this.
Mm-hmm.
But they make sort of the same sort of moves that you would see, as if you would assume that someone else would fix it. But this movie starts off with a bizarro exposition thing of what was it? Previously on, or you may have missed, or
if it says something to the tune of for those of you who came in late. It's like,
yes.
This is the first frame of the movie.
Yeah, which I theorize has to come from the comics, because it turns up a lot if you Google search for the things that specific line. A lot of fan pages and stuff named that. I can't find the original source of what that might be, but I assume it's all comics related, and it's probably very very obvious to people who are fans of the comic. If you are, as we are, people watching a movie,
human beings watching a film,
yeah, you would be confused. But it doesn't matter, because it's just the silliest exposition of there was a boy who was on a boat and it was attacked by pirates, and those pirates killed his father, and then he was rescued by these people on this made-up island, and they adopted him into their own society so that he would and then he swore to like grow up and beat up jerks. And so that was the start of the Phantom, and that's passed down through the generations. We don't, of course, see all of that as a montage or anything. That'd be silly. What we do get is the James Remar "We're in a Truck" scene with comedy improv. If newbie guy next to him, and they have abducted a kid from the island who supposedly is of some value in knowing where something is, but it doesn't matter because they can't talk to him.
They use him to drive a truck over a rickety bridge in case the bridge breaks, the kid will die instead of them.
Yeah, but then they don't have a truck. I don't understand. But
yeah, and I was like, do you already have the stuff in the truck? Because then you're going to lose your truck and your stuff, and you'll be stranded on the wrong side of the thing.
Yeah, it was just like, why don't you just leave the truck here? And then just go walk on the other side, get the thing, go back to the truck, and then drive across. Because even if you get whatever it is you're looking for, do you want to put it on the truck and then drive the truck across again?
And they didn't even steal so much stuff that they couldn't just carry it with them back to where the truck was.
No.
Bring a rucksack, fill it up, be fine.
What was funny is James Remar has a line when they get into the cave of steal anything, you know, grab whatever. And it's just like, but it's really not that much here. Like, everybody could just grab like one thing. There's like paperweights.
And then the thing with the skeleton.
Oh, it's so cheesy. The skeleton comes.
A skeleton comes alive and grabs one of the guys and is kind of like choking-ish him, sort of shaking him. And then James Remar shoots the skeleton and it like drops the guy. But the skeleton just still kind of stands there because it's a skeleton, and the guy falls down and he's dead.
Yeah, and he's like, tell that, and James Remar has some line where they're like, oh, we should get out of here, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, tell that to what's-his-face. And it's like, he's literally just lying under you while you're saying this. Like, this doesn't, and how does the skeleton choke somebody? It can't wrap around his throat or anything. It's just like, it's a stick. This thing is like a stick. That stuck out at him.
A stick made out of bone.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I meant to lead off, give an opening statement about this movie. You know, from time to time, we'll do a movie that's so bad where I'll mention when we start doing the podcast, like between the time that I saw the movie and we started talking about it, I kind of forgot about the movie. Not only did I forget that I had watched this movie, I forgot we had a podcast tonight until like a half hour before when you started texting me again. I'm like, oh, yeah, right. I watched a movie earlier today, and also we have to talk about it. What was that movie? Man, it's this purple guy. He was fighting some people.
Wow, this really washed right out of your brain.
It really did, and I was trying to focus. Like, there were a couple of times where I started, like, Googling, like, some of the people or something, and it was like, wait, I think I just missed something important, and I rewind. It was like, oh, that wasn't really important. It was just that there was a guy in a tuxedo who was snitching to Drax, or whatever the hell his name was, Xander Drax, that the newspaper was looking into him. So mm-hmm. like, I'm glad I rewound to see that vital bit of information here.
Yeah, because the bad guys from this cave, from the skeleton specifically, they steal a silver skull with what appear to be, like, I don't know, sapphire eyes, and it's the same, one of the same skulls that we saw in the opening scene with the three skulls. So this guy, Quill, James Remar's character, has it, and they get out of there, and they're chased by the Phantom, who was...
I like that we have a Drax and a Quill in this movie.
I wonder if that was on purpose. But so anyway, the Phantom is sitting completely in Phantom garb on his throne, pondering the existence of the universe or something, when all of a sudden he gets the sensation that someone has robbed something somewhere, and then he sprints out of the cave. It is Wolf follows him. It's so weird. Like, it's just like, is your brain like a home alarm? Like, the ghost of the skeleton thing, like, was like, hey, go get it. And you just happen to be sitting around your house, like...
Maybe his purple spandex conducts radio waves or something.
Yeah, but, like, do you just sit around, just dress like that a lot? Because that's a little... that's a little strange.
You know, it's comfy. It's like,
Is it?
I mean, it's basically like proto yoga pants, and I'm given to understand that they're very comfortable, which is why they're frequently worn.
No, but yoga pants have like some room in the crotch. Like, there's no room here for anything.
Well, he's got matching purple sort of like tidy whiteys above the spandex legs.
So he hops on his horse and skedaddles to the cave.
It doesn't really help that his gigantic belt buckle with a skull on it is a triangle kind of pointing directly down, saying, check this out. Look what I got going on here.
You see this skull? It's connected to the bone. But anyway.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, he confronts James Remar and his 5-cent hooligans who don't know how to act or anything. I love how the first guy, he just gently touches him around the back of his neck as he slowly walks him towards a tree and it incapacitates him somehow, and then the wolf watches over him, and then of course it's basically like an Alaskan Malamute or something that's like very domesticated in order to be trained for production, which is often a problem whenever you see wolves in TV shows, because they're happy and they want to have fun. And so he's not threatening. He's not a threatening dog.
I love that one shot where the guy's laying on the ground and you can see the wolf way in the background, like running. And then it cuts to the wolf just like standing there, like getting in a solo shot. And then when it growls, they tilt down to the guy. And it's like, okay, so you had to wait for the dog to finally get angry before you could get the shot. There's no continuity whatsoever, but whatever, you got your growly dog shot.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is genuinely a problem with filming dogs that look like wolves, because they're just so happy. On The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, the wolves are surrounding the beaver house, and they're all going towards it, and there's an aerial shot going down on all from above, looking down at all the wolves approaching the hut, and you can see all their tails wagging, so they all had to be painted out, and CG wolf tails had to be put in that weren't wagging, so they wouldn't look like they're having fun.
Did you have a part in doing that?
I may have helped with some touch-ups, but that was not primarily my shot, but I had other wolf shots, but they are, so this wolf throughout the movie, not a threat. I question the need to put it in there, other than he does have a wolf in the comic. But if that is the case, just be like, hey, look, it's my wolf, and he's going to hang out here in this cave the entire rest of the movie. He doesn't need to go anywhere. But for some reason, he's got to go along for this stuff. But the Phantom chases them to the bridge. The truck gets all wound up and things, and we get our first set piece of the truck flipping over, and he goes in and he saves the kid, and then the truck falls down, goes boom. For some reason, Phantom can't speak the language of the kid who is from this island where the Phantom grew up. But that goes back to the problematic origins of the Phantom as like a white savior who comes into another
he's
nation.
From Africa. He's from a fake country in Africa.
Not so much from the country.
He was born right there in that cave.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, hilarious.
$45 million budget.
Did it look like $45 million?
Hell no.
I think they spent a lot of their budget on renting everything to make Art Deco New York, and then the rest of the movie they just did not care about.
Mm. There were a lot of visual effects credits in the IMDb listing, amazingly.
Yeah. I mean, this is the right at the start of digital compositing, so there's not like huge optical matte lines around stuff.
Right. This is 1996.
Yeah, this is 1 year before Titanic.
This is after Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
God, that really recontextualizes this movie.
Yeah. You sound so sad. Did you think it was older than 1996 or newer than 1996?
Parts of it felt much older. Much older. Like, mm-hmm. when you see his outfit, you're picturing the Adam West Batman movie. What year was that? Like 66?
Yeah, 66, 67, I think. Something like that.
So somewhere, my brain puts it somewhere between 1996 and 1966.
Yeah. Well, supposedly, they had a rubber Phantom suit, like Michael Keaton's rubber Batman suit for the Tim Burton Batman. Because obviously, Michael Keaton, I don't know if you know this, never was as ripped as the costume with the cladding armor mm-hmm. that looks mm-hmm. like abs and pecs and stuff. But apparently, Billy Zane had worked out enough where they were confident that they wouldn't need to use that, and so they went with the spandex.
He's in good shape. He's got some big, broad shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
But he still looks like he's wearing spandex.
Yes, that is 100% true. You can't put, no matter how buff a person is, you just can't put them in spandex. They just look like Gumby.
They look like a big teddy bear.
but he saves the kid, and James Remar gets away with the skull, and we go to the cave where we are introduced to the Phantom's servant. Which is, again, not appropriate, really. But you know, the servant seems really into it and calling him the ghost who walks and stuff. But it's really like in that Johnny Quest, you know, Haji territory with that.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed some Johnny Quest, and then did you ever watch the was it just called like Young Johnny Quest or whatever? Did you ever watch that show?
Well, there was a. What was it? There was that one where they put in the CGVR or whatever thing. Remember that?
What?
Yeah. There was the New Adventures of Johnny Quest, I think, or something. And it was like a weird anime style. But then they had like a CG virtual reality world where they fought some bad guy who looked ridiculous. And it was all very like Tron inspired. I want to say it was the late 90s.
The New Adventures. Yeah. This is the one that I watched. I distinctly remember there was an episode where they investigated the alien origins of the big stone heads from Easter Island.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, what is this VR thing?
How did you forget that? It was even in the opening credits.
I don't think I've ever seen this, but this is horrible. So this was part of the same show, Race and Surd fighting in Quest World.
Yes.
From season 2's Cyber Switch. Yeah. Copy image address. Paste. This looks like, what's the show that we've talked about a couple of times where they're in a computer and they're little computer people? Was it called like Replay or something?
Reboot.
It's like Reboot quality, except maybe mm-hmm. worse.
Yeah.
I like Reboot.
Yeah, this is around the same time, a little couple years after. Yeah, the Surd was the name of the bad guy. I couldn't remember. It's bad. It is genuinely bad. But anywho,
Bounty Quest is probably incredibly problematic nowadays, isn't it?
Oh, it's so problematic, so incredibly problematic. Just go watch some clips of that, and it's just like, oh, so these white scientist, friendly white scientist people are gonna go in and fix things, and there's a lot of seemingly Southeast Asian evil people. That's a strange choice. But yes, Johnny Quest is very weird. This movie takes from the Phantom comic and also introduces a lot of weirdness that you would find, of course, in the era. That includes just sort of being like, hey, so we've made up a fake culture that seems like a conglomeration of just general white people understandings of flipping through a book in the library. So this guy's going to be his servant, and the white guy's going to be the one who saves all of these people. So that's great. It's good stuff. You even have literal colonialist British forces there with the Jungle Patrol and the commander of the Jungle Patrol.
Oh yeah, there's the fellow with the name for that like safari looking hat, the hard safari hat.
Yeah, I don't know. They always look so silly. But so Billy Zane is topless reading a book while his wounds are being mended, and
a very large book that you would expect. Like the Wizard in Fantasia to be reading or something.
Also, he's reading it like he just learned to read, which is a little weird, because he's like, and then there are skulls that blah, blah, blah. He's just like, Jesus, like, you studied abroad in America for, like, all of those years, and that's presumably why you can't speak any languages on this island that you're theoretically from, but you at the same time can't read anything that's written in this book. But anyway, this gives us the helpful explanation that somebody wrote down that, oh, hey, there's magic skulls that we just seemingly lost track of because the Sang Brotherhood pirates made off with two of them, and then the other one was put into a cave, I guess.
Can I give you a quick aside, quick question for you?
Yes.
You know what else was kind of popular in the... 90s. There was a particular ad campaign for a product of beverage that you may or may not have been familiar with, named milk. Do you remember the beverage milk from the 90s?
No. Drawing a blank. Are you
apparently
talking about like literal milk, or is this some sort
literal
of
literal milk? Apparently, the Phantom did an ad for milk. There's the Phantom sitting on his stone throne with a milk mustache, and it's not the Got Milk campaign that everyone remembers. It says milk. What a surprise! Exclamation point. It says, after a grueling day of defending the earth from piracy, greed, and cruelty, I just can't wait to get home, kick back, and pour myself a drink of milk, that is, with 9 essential nutrients that help make me strong, like protein, calcium, and vitamin D. It's the beverage of choice for most superheroes.
Oh my god, he looks like he's in a sex dungeon. What is going on?
Do you know where I found this image? It's on Amazon. You can buy this poster.
Oh my god.
It's an 11 by 8 teen magazine poster pinup clipping of Billy's. Apparently he wasn't even Billy Zane back then. He was William Zane Jr. Oh, I know what I'm getting you for next Christmas. I'm going to add this to my cart right now. Only two left in stock. Bye, bye, bye.
Also, I just have to point out, his milk mustache.
It's so bad.
It's not a milk mustache. It's like somebody like took white paint and just sort of made what they thought a mustache looked like on the top of his lip. Like, it's not even over his lower lip. Yeah.
Most of the Got Milk ads kind of had that really fake, horrible looking milk mustache thing going on. But this is like in the shape of like a stick on mustache.
This is a white porn stash. It is really weird.
Oh boy, $6.98. I mean, it's not available on Prime. That's a bit of a bummer.
Come see Billy Zane in purple spandex, knee-high leather boots, and a white mustache sitting in a sex dungeon for a milk campaign. Oy.
Boy. Boy, oh boy.
Did we mention yet that this was Paramount hoping that they would launch a trilogy of Phantom films?
You did not mention that yet, no.
Yeah, see, this was going to be the first one, and then there were the other two that came, except they didn't come because this was an enormous bomb at the box office for very obvious reasons. But it's just amazing to me. Number of people who didn't think this was going to bomb, up to and including Billy Zane.
Well, they had a lot of source IP to draw from to make additional movies, I imagine. Apparently, this I was unaware, became a 2-episode television movie series in 2010, 2009.
I was unaware of this.
He looks like he's wearing a helmet from Dread.
what?
Here, let me send you the IMDb thing on this. I assume.
I don't believe you.
This man in purple, in a TV movie called The Phantom, is the Phantom that we are speaking of. Maybe he's the 22nd Phantom, because he's not Kirk. Whatever. What the hell is his name? Kip.
Yeah, Kit Walker.
Kit Walker. It's not Kit Walker. He's Chris Moore.
Isabella Rossellini was in this trash. What? What?
Dr. Bella Lothia. Oh God. What do you think? Who do you think Dr. Deepak Babur is? Is an appropriately representative character?
Oh, I don't know if I want to know. Okay, so law student Chris Moore is an urban daredevil who gets his kicks from racing across rooftops when a secret organization approaches him with proof he is actually the son of a legendary international crime fighter called the Phantom. He is thrust into a world he never knew existed, a world of exotic islands, secret lairs, and heritage that borders on royalty, and reimagined and reloaded. The classic superhero is upgraded for the 21st century with a new state-of-the-art costume and a newly formed rivalry against some of the most techno-savvy villains to ever terrorize the world.
Oh, God, I hate those techno-savvy villains.
It's explosive action and nonstop adventure from start to finish. The Phantom comes to life.
Techno-savvy villains. There's nothing worse than a villain that knows, like, all of the secret booleans to use on Google.
Yes.
If you put it in quotes, you can find the Phantom Lair.
Yeah. If you use the minus, you can say all the results that don't have wolf in them. But yeah, no. Oh, woof. Yikes. There was also a television cartoon series that looked very Eon Fluxy, called like Phantom 20 something 99 or whatever. Mm. I don't remember the name of it. But that was on for a while. I think it lasted longer than the movie, or apparently this 2-episode TV movie feature. Jeez.
I didn't intend to derail us there, but it feels like if you, I couldn't resist showing you this poster. I want to make this my background on my computer. Oh, it's so disturbing.
Mm. Yeah, The Phantom.
What does it say down here? 1996 National Fluid Milk Processor Promotion Board. Does that mean there's non-fluid milk?
There's powdered milk.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have just said milk promotion board.
Yeah, because milk, canonically, I think, is the liquid form. And then you add the powdered for the powdered variant. I think just regular milk is just the liquid kind.
Yeah. Saying fluid milk processing. Fluid. Processing is also a great word. It makes you just think of good things.
You don't hear a lot of beverages referred to as fluids.
Because they are fluids because they're beverages.
I mean, yeah, but like when the word fluid is usually used for things like brake fluid or transmission fluid.
Mm-hmm, or gender. But so... this movie,
Oh, I was going to make a bad joke.
Don't do it. Don't be a Virginia.
No, I wasn't
executive.
Oh, is that what is he doing the inverse of that?
No. I was just saying. I'm just waiting for that to happen. Like 5 minutes from now, I'm sure it's gonna happen. Just getting out in front of that news item. But the thing here is now we go to New York and we are introduced to newspaper uncle daddy, whatever he is, and then
Uncle Daddy. Yep, that's his name.
Because she's his niece, right? Yes.
Yeah, they're very close.
Yeah, they're very close for that being the niece, but whatever. But
I don't know about you, but I don't ever just like roll up into my rich uncle's house and go like, you know what, I'm gonna go make a sandwich in the kitchen. It's good to see you. Have a good time at your party.
Or send me to your super secret information gathering mission in a dangerous place. But whatever. She's very persuasive with her, I'm going to do this. And they're just like, okay. But she does that a lot in this film. We are introduced to her drip of a boyfriend who there are actually a couple like funny little quirky moments where he's written to not understand that he is a drip, but says the things that let us in the audience know that he is a drip. However, he's not in much of this movie, so I don't really care. He could have entirely been removed and it would not have been an issue. But the weird thing here is we at this party, Drax is introduced, and that's played by Treat Williams, who is not a treat, FYI. He is not hammy enough to chew the scenery for this role, but at the same time is not serious enough for this. So he's in a weird middle ground where he somehow has moments of trying to be that campy, weird Batman villain, and then other times...
Why did I not remember his name was Treat?
I don't know.
Sounds like a middle name, too.
Sounds like you're mistreating him.
Do you think there was another Richard Williams in the Screen Actors Guild and he had to go by his middle name, or did he just really want to like stand out?
I mean, Richard Williams is a pretty common name. There's at least an animator that I know of named Richard Williams. Famous animator. I don't know if he's in the Screen Actors Guild. But Drax is in with all of the people, apparently. Mayor and police commissioner and stuff. So...
But he also has kind of a quirky, weird sense of humor, too, in this movie. Like, they tried to inject a lot of their humor into his character specifically.
Yeah, yeah. But it doesn't always work, because it just makes you question why anyone would listen to him or follow him anywhere.
Or maybe it's just the thing where everyone has to laugh at the boss's jokes, because you don't want to get fired.
Yeah, or get it. Spear in your back, but they're mixing at the mixer, and the editor boss Uncle Daddy is like, no, you gotta go, like, sample canapes on your way out because they're delicious, but leave, and
make sure you get a to-go bag too, because I don't want you to go home hungry.
Yeah, they're really good canapes. They're really good canapes. Go away forever. Eat the canapes.
Don't forget, we have some party favors on your way out. Get into the coat check desk on your way to the valet, but I don't ever want to see you again. It was lovely having you stop by.
Hope you appreciate it. Goodbye forever. But
say hello to Maureen for me. Now get out of here.
It was weird. The whole editor Uncle Daddy is very strange, because we go up to his briefing on why he's so concerned with the mayor and the police commissioner, who seem to be buddy-buddy with the Drax guy that was just kicked out, which would be, I don't know, a red flag where he'd be like, maybe don't tell them why you're worried about Drax, because if you're worried about them stopping your story or anything, then don't do that. But he doesn't really seem to care. He's like, so I found something very serious. He's been checking a lot of books in the occult section. It's like, why is this serious? Why is anyone concerned? Why is the newspaper writer concerned? What is he going to run in the paper? secretly checks out occult books and looks at them.
Maybe he's writing a screenplay. You don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because in the world of this movie, magic is not shown to be real in any way for the people of New York. So why would any of them take any stock in what he's saying about how Drax is researching the supernatural? Doesn't mean anything. There's no example of the supernatural doing anything so far in the film. So it doesn't seem to be damning evidence in any regard, you know? But he leans hard into that, and then he's like, oh, so I'm going to go and get the thing. And then What's-Her-Face is like, no, Editor Uncle Daddy, I'll go do it. And she goes on her Pan Am flight that takes 2 seconds on the seaplane, which...
They really get on all sides of the planet, like, really quickly in these little tiny seaplanes.
My favorite... My absolute favorite is much later in the film when they're on the seaplane from New York to somewhere in an island in the Indian Sea. It's just like, what? How did you do that? and Billy Zane was apparently hanging on to the pontoon for the whole trip.
At least he kind of feigned being kind of tired, like when they were starting to like descend and bank a little bit, and it like threw him off the side and he was dangling. But yeah, no. Maybe because it's a seaplane, they can't fly more than like 200 feet off the ground or whatever, so he wouldn't like freeze or fall off or die.
I have no idea. Or maybe they've been stopping frequently for refuelings, and he just gets off and waits in the duck in the water, and then
he
hops
stretches
back on
his legs and runs over to the Circle K and uses the bathroom and gets a snack.
Oh man, that's just not hygienic to be in that wet spandex suit the whole entire time. But
no, there's probably a fair amount of chafing too, because it is skin tight.
Also, where are you gonna poop?
I mean, what do you mean, where is it gonna go?
Yeah,
into the ocean, man. You're hanging above the ocean.
Yeah, but like, what does he do? Just like releases one hand from the seaplane and then just pulls part of his pants down.
You want me to draw you a diagram?
So yes, me a diagram.
So here's what you do: you straddle one of the little posts that connect the skid to the top of the plane. You drop your trowel a little bit. You sort of lean back away from the post and do a little bit of a squat, so you're kind of hovering above, you know, the air in the ocean, and you let her fly.
But if you're hugging the skid, then aren't you going to get skid marks?
You're standing on the skid. You're hugging the post.
Standing on the skid, hugging the post. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to fall.
No, that would be silly. But the whole thing with the seaplanes is just nonsense. But they land and are immediately boarded by pirates, who take What's-Her-Face hostage, and what is it, Diana something, whatever. Christy Swanson's character. Also, again, I should reiterate, Christy Swanson, not a nice person. She's a right-wing troll online these days.
Oh, and, is she?
Yeah. We had discussed that when we had done our episode on Dude, Where's My Car? Because she briefly has a cameo in there as Christy Boner.
Christy Boner, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, so she's like James Wood level.
Oh, she really James Wood level?
Yeah, yeah. It's not great, Dan.
More like Christy Boner Killer.
Whoa, Jesus.
Oh, that was bad.
Yeah. Not like all of our other things we said so far. That's been gold.
Yeah, man. Nobody's going to listen to this episode,
no.
Thankfully.
No. But they flew, and landed and got boarded. And Catherine Zeta-Jones is a pirate with flight goggles that get ripped off by Christy Swanson, and she then punches Christy Swanson out in like the fakest way, and then they let everybody go, which is stupid, because if you're going to take somebody hostage and you don't want everyone else to know, then you would just kill everybody else, I guess.
I'll be honest, this section of the film kind of went in one eyeball and out the other, or whatever the phrase is, because I know there were pirates and there was running around, and then they jumped on. Wait, was there another plane, or was a boat or something? There was escaping involved, and then
yeah. Well, here, let me walk you through it real quick. Then the Phantom overhears on the radio that the Phantom Servant overhears on the radio that there are hostages, and then the Phantom Servant tells the Ghost Who Walks that he should listen to the radio, and then the Ghost Who Walks says literally the thing that the guy said, and then goes over to talk to Captain What's-His-Face about it at the British camp. And he's like, why don't you just use the front door? And he says, you know, oh, it's just better to come in this way and nobody will notice. And it's like, okay, it's great. You know, we don't want anyone to notice that we're meeting. It's like, all right, homosexual tension in here. That's fine. But they go through the whole thing about how there is apparently the abducted What's-Her-Face Palmer, Chrissy Swanson's character. And he's like, oh, I know who that is. And it's like, sigh. Apparently there was like a few love scenes with the two of them that was somehow in here somewhere that was going to be in here that was filmed in Thailand. But
between whom?
Between Billy Zane and What's-Her-Face as like, I guess, flashbacks at some point. But
oh, to their college days?
Yeah, but was not used. So
you gotta mind that rating.
Yeah.
PG.
Mm-hmm. The director said he removed it for pacing.
Oh, sure. Because you really need those like long 15-second tracking shots of like watching a horse come up from the distance or whatever.
Yeah. If there's one thing I would never say about this director is that he was concerned about pacing.
it is even an hour and 40 minutes somehow.
Yeah, it really doesn't feel like it ought to be, but so he has his chit-chat with the captain guy, and then the captain guy's like, you better leave back out the same way you came in. You can't have anybody know that you're here. And it's like, wait, you just yelled at him for not using your front door, and now you're telling him to leave through the back? Come on. Come on. Be a little more consistent. But he goes, and he talks to, I guess, the kid who's like, oh, yeah, the pirates are over at this cove. They use plane-like feet, you know, whatever. And he's like, oh, great, it's good that you said it like that, so that way I know it's something to do with seaplanes, because I don't speak the same language as you for some reason, even though we're on the same island again. But he goes with the kid over there, and then he's like, kid, go tell your people to do whatever. And then he goes over to the boat with seaplanes and has his wolf scouted out, even though it's not like he can see through the eyes of the wolf or anything, so I don't know what good that does to anybody. But
maybe it's like bark once for turn left, bark twice for turn right, because the wolf can see them.
Oh, it's like tapping you on your wrist like your Apple Watch. But he goes in the water, then pops up and goes inside the ship, sees the airboats and stuff, and then it stumbles into the locker room, and he's like, freeze! And then it's all ladies. And they're all concerned about a man in spandex that has apparently wandered into the bathroom. So he gets out of there, and then he comes across Captain Zeta-Jones, who is with Chrissy Swanson. And Chrissy Swanson gets untied and then punches out with the stage punch I was mocking earlier, Catherine Zeta-Jones. And then she's like, I know how to get out of here. I'm going to save myself. And he's like, I'm here to save you. And he's like, I'm going to save myself. And he's like,
don't forget, as soon as he drops in out of the laundry chute, Catherine Zeta-Jones is like, well, hello, and like kisses him. And he's like, hi, I'm here to rescue the other girl.
I mean, they kind of wanted to have this weird sort of like Michael Keaton, Catwoman, and Han Solo, Princess Leia thing going on in the scene. I don't know. It's weird. Because it doesn't work at all. And Chrissy Swanson is supposed to be like the Princess Leia, who's like, no, I'm going to rescue myself from the prison cell. But it does not work. Because she's very stilted. It doesn't make any sense that she would know where anything was. And yet she's like marching off out of there to go defend herself unarmed. And they get out to one of the boat planes and hop on board and make it out of there just in the nick of time for James Remar to shoot the plane. And then there's a shot of the undamaged plane. And then later on, we see a close-up shot of fuel, quote-unquote, leaking out of the plane from the bullet holes. And they have to do a landing, but they can't land because it's a seaplane. So he calls on his trusty horse, who somehow catches up to an airplane They hopped down onto the pontoons, and he locked the stick, and then they hopped from the pontoon onto the horse, and then the plane smashes into the side of a cliff that's nearby.
Yeah, this section of the film is one of the worst things I've seen. So bad. Like, you get the horse running fast. As fast as an airplane, and in that particular shot, the airplane is clearly static, and I think they're just kind of like moving the camera around a little bit. And then there's like all of the various stunt doubles, and just like it's also very clearly just stitched together in whatever way that they could make happen. But my goodness,
yeah, no, it's really sloppy, and it's not dramatic. Everything takes place at a really slow pace. Plane is just sitting in midair for a really long time before they jump off, etc.
It is so incredibly long, like so long.
I there's no urgency to their movements, but they get on the horse and they ride off back out of there to stuff. And it's like he takes her to the special hidey hole where a British imperialist. We're a British imperialist guy and his servant are, and he has
no smoking in the skull cave.
Yeah.
Is that the fandom's version of no sex in the champagne?
I don't know. I mean, I don't want any smoking anywhere.
This is a 400-year-old, very sacred religious skull shaped cavern. You can't burn it down. I love also that he has that just that like tiny little garden gate protecting all of the jewels and things too.
Silly.
And you can clearly tell like when he like swings it closed, like it doesn't actually close, but they used a sound cue to like make it seem like it locked securely.
Yeah. Man, the Foley work in this movie. Jeez. Especially when they get to the machine room later in the elevator and stuff.
It's all so bad.
Yeah. So they. He pawns off the rescued Chrissy Swanson onto the imperialist British dude to take her back home, and she's like, "I just got here." Blah blah blah. It's like, no, you were kidnapped. You didn't get anywhere. So please go home. And he hatches his plan that he's going to go to New York, but he can't go on the same plane or something. I guess I don't know how many planes do you think there are that are taking off out of here on a daily basis.
Frequently, like how often do they get? I mean, doesn't seem like Southwest or United flies to this place. So
no, I don't think it's a hub, but
not a hub.
But he, for some reason, he's able to get on a different flight than the one she's on because they get to New York within seemingly hours of one another.
Within like 10 minutes, like he walks into the uncle's editor, uncle daddy's office, like right before she gets there.
Yeah. And it's so weird too, because he's even had like a further delay than she has had because he's like negotiating with apparently costume jewelry to get where he needs to go.
Oh, I didn't think about the fact that I don't have American money. Here's some jewels that I keep wrapped up in my pocket if I ever come across crazy Americans.
Yes, who demand Mardi Gras beads. Like, it is... It doesn't even look real, the close-up. Like, he just looks so plastic.
Was it necessary for the cab driver to be skeptical, but then when he comes back out, he's like, while you were in there, I got all these jewels appraised at the corner jeweler appraiser guy, and he told me they were very valuable, so I'm going to drive you around for the next day and be your best friend and
risk
defender
my
now.
Life for you. Yeah. It didn't make any sense. It would have been better had he just been like, hey, here's like a wad of actual cash. We're going to cut out the silly I don't know how money works scene. Because obviously I should know how money works because I lived in America.
Any James Bond movies where you like you have a cigar box with like a little bit of currency from all of the countries around the world when you're doing your international traveling and things?
Yeah, or but he also has been to like this isn't a surprise. He was in America 6 years ago. Like he knows that he needs cash. So I don't understand why he wouldn't at least be like, hey, currency exchange person at the airport, here's my costume jewelry. Please give me cash. But the fact that he waits till
he's like... A little window where they like totally screw you with the exchange rate.
Yeah, well, he doesn't really seem very concerned about exchange rates because he's just like, here's a bag of plastic jewelry. But he convinces the cab driver through this action to wait for him. What I like is that here's all this Bengala cash, and it's like, this is a wad of paper that nobody even bothered to like dress appropriately for this camera shot. But how does that island print its own paper money? I don't understand.
Maybe it's made out of animal skins.
It doesn't make any sense. But he goes to Editor Uncle Daddy's office, and he meets What's-Her-Face, who's there with her drip boyfriend, and they talk about what Drax is up to and how long it's been since they've seen each other, and we were friends in college, and it's like, ah, blah. But then the drip pipes in with the oh, yeah, I saw a skull thing, but it wasn't silver, it was green. And this is my favorite acting moment for Billy Zane in the whole movie, where he goes, green, and then there's like a literal pause, and then he moves his arms to the side, arms akimbo, with your elbows pointing out on either side, and then he looks up and he goes, jade. And it's like, oh my god, like, you didn't need to spell that out at all. Like, that would have been fine if you just like kept that in your head. And you definitely did not need to do arms akimbo. This was not an arms akimbo justified scene. Like, what is going on? Just the acting's not good. But they decide to go to the museum and get the green skull thing that What's-His-Face saw, because there are no cultures around the world that have any skull iconography at all. But they show up there. And they find it inside of a treasure chest with a fleur-de-lis in there and some other crap. And it's just like, oh, they completely mischaracterized the culture that it's from. And Billy Zane's chuckling to himself. And then she's like, well, I know somebody. My Uncle Daddy knows somebody who's on the board of whatever. And we can get blah, blah, blah. And he just like takes up like a stanchion and then just busts the glass and takes out the skull. But he hops into the display. And then with the fedora down, very purposefully down, very, very much looking at literally inches in front of his feet, he hops back down again, and then he moves his head up, and stealthily, Drax and all of his henchmen had moved into the room, which doesn't make any sense. But Drax has them cornered and guns drawn, etc., and then he gets the skull. And then the skulls start smoking in the bag when they're put next to each other, and then he pulls them out, and they start a laser light show, and there's like a spotlight that's behind a palm frond that's moving around a lot on one of the walls. But the laser lights added in CG later on somehow look around the room and are like, hey, look, that's a map. Let me draw something on the map.
Yeah, I mean, both skulls have eyes so that they can scan the room and determine if there are any maps in the room for them to blast at. But apparently he didn't even like look at the map really to see like what it was. He just like wrote down the latitude and longitude lines of the burnt dot on the map.
Yep.
So he could go look it up later.
I should say that those old maps, not known for their accuracy.
You mean the ones that say like dragon over here,
yes,
volcano
exactly.
Over there.
But so there's one of those up there, and it is basically the coast of Thailand and Malaysia and in India. It's visible on the map, and there's a little tiny island that gets blasted. So it's just a scorch mark. So somehow they derive.
The museum caretaker's gonna come in and be like, "What in the hell?"
Yeah, yeah. But it's so obvious that they wanted to do the map room scene from Indiana Jones, but they were just like,
because of the laser blast directly at it.
Yeah, but they're like, we just don't have anything to motivate this. Okay, well, here's a map. Zap it. And then that's it. That's the level of thinking that went into it.
Zap it a map.
Zap it a meppo. But they
zoop it a meepo.
They figure that out, and then they're like, who are you guys? We'll take you back to headquarters. And so they all file out of there, and the taxi guy is following them back to Drax's office building, And they go inside, and I should say the Art Deco set dressing is lovely, but the translite out the window is one of the worst.
All of these sets were totally left over from another movie, right?
I have to assume. But man, the translite is so bad. It's like they have all of these shots where you're like panning over, and the translite is underlit, so it's basically darker than the lights inside of the room, even though it's supposed to be outside at daylight. And there is a basically what amounts to a cutout of a skyline that you would see inside of like a New York pizza parlor knockoff thing. Like, it doesn't in any way look like a skyscraper. But they have it back there, and they pan over near it a couple of times. I wonder if they knew it didn't look that great and didn't hold up to camera, so they were just like keeping it at the edge of frame or something. But it was just like my eye was drawn to it, because it was like you can see the perspective on this completely flat thing that is 1 foot on the other side of where you put your window. But it was hilarious because like they spent a lot of time and effort and money on renting whatever set dressing it was they were using inside the Art Deco office. But weird.
Yeah, without looking, do you know where some of these indoor interior things were filmed?
Los Angeles, and I want to say Australia.
Yes, Australia. Mm-hmm. There are also a couple notable residences in Los Angeles that were filmed in, apparently, for this.
Oh. Was it the What's-Its-Face house from The Rocketeer?
Which one was... I don't remember the name of it.
It was one of the Frank Lloyd Wright houses.
The Fancy Flank... No. This lists Greystone Park and Mansion.
Oh, yes.
And this one has an addendum that says Diana Palmer's house, even though it was Uncle Daddy's house or whatever.
Yeah.
That is the Playboy Mansion.
Oh.
Apparently.
Oh, dear.
I mean, it did have a very grand entrance, but... Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Huh. I wonder if the museum was...
Greystone.
Maybe.
I could see that.
But they... For this office is definitely not a real place anywhere. Catherine Zeta-Jones is on a couch and then reveals herself and then slaps Kirstie Swanson again to get her back for evening the score or something. I don't know. It's stupid. They played this whole like weird cat fight, you know, girl against girl for the affections of a man tension thing for half of this movie. And then they just said, nope, we don't care anymore. They're best friends now. It's like, what? But this is the catfight part. So anyway, they have this weird tension between the two of them. And then Drax is like, who are you? And blah, blah, blah. Oh, that's a cute answer. You're cute. Take him up to the roof and something. And so Quill takes him off. And this is when Kit notices the skeleton head belt buckle that matches his on Quill. And is like, oh, gee, I wonder if this is the person who killed my father. And they go up
he has a belt buckle just like mine, which is weird.
Yeah, so they go up the stairs a little, and then he incapacitates them very quickly. Well, not incapacitates, but knocks them over, I guess, and then gets to the machine room. They go chasing after him. And it's a spooky machine room where there's lights coming from the other side of fans, casting shadows.
The machine room.
It's bad.
This is the gif where where the feet come in and hit him with the head.
This is my favorite action cue in the whole movie, because they were just like, you know, we saw Goldeneye, and Famke Jensen strangles people to death with her thighs. So why don't we just have Billy Zane do that? But because he's a guy, let's have him take out two guys at the same time. And it's like, do you people think about this stuff before you do it? But I guess not.
And this is the scene I was watching when I told you, like, he couldn't have given away his identity more if he had tried, because like they say, like, lead him up to the machine room and kill him. And like three guys are taking regular Billy Zane up there, and then like he knocks him out of the way and escapes and runs into the machine room where he was going in the first place, and then they follow in after, and his clothes are on the ground, and they pick up his clothes and they're like, whoa, And then the purple legs come in and grab him around the neck. And it's like, literally, who else could it possibly be?
Nope. No way of knowing.
And it's not like Superman, who like ran out one side of the building and then flew around the other side. Like, Billy Zane left going up the stairs, and then if the Phantom comes back down the stairs, Xander's going to be like, "What? What? Why are you wearing purple suit now, Kit?"
Yes.
Or whatever the hell his name is.
Well, also, you'll notice that James Remar is there for this disrobing. When he goes in, he sees the clothes, he sees that there is the Phantom there. So he has observed this. He doesn't report any of this to Drax. He doesn't say what happened to Kit at all. He just says that the Phantom's there. Why not just say Kit is the Phantom or something? So you don't look like an idiot. But they just seemingly forget that Kit existed for the rest of the film, which is a peculiar move. But they,
and I just love when he comes to see he sees the cab guy, and the cab guy, he's like, he jumps in the cab and he's like, "Don't worry, I'm a friend of Kit, the guy who paid you a bunch of money. Now drive." The cab driver, who can't possibly be as naive as everyone else in this movie, because he's from New York and he drives a cab, he should be like, "Oh, it's you, isn't it? You're wearing a suit now, but like,
mm-hmm.
you're the same guy.
Should have known you were some kinky stuff." But no, it's, but he doesn't drive off, and then the cops who are on the payroll of Drax, you know, are opening the car door, and the Phantom escapes out the other side and then jumps across three cabs and then goes next to a movie marquee for a Paramount Pictures production of something something. And then he hops on a police horse, and then he rides the police horse through a park.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the park is made to look like Central Park, except it's not. And the motorcycles are chasing
him. This is apparently the Park Plaza Hotel
mm-hmm.
in Los Angeles.
Nice.
Where the Phantom and motorcycle cops jump over a hedge, according to IMDb.
It really looks like they jumped over a hedge. It's like, we've got one hedge, guys. Don't mess it up.
How many different angles can we get this hedge from?
So stupid. But they jump over it with the horse and the motorcycles. And then he gets off the horse, gets in the cab. The cab takes him to the docks where the seaplane that Drax is going to take off from is. I mean, how do you just go like, "Oh yes, I know all of the New York dock slips and which one Drax's plane would be and et cetera."
Well, you know, you got your international one because he knows where they're headed out of the country.
I mean, I guess, but it's a kind of a private plane. But they arrive, and then he barely makes it onto the plane, and then, like we said, he poops off the pontoon for the rest of the movie until they land in that island that is somewhere near the coast of Thailand. And apparently Drax knew where to go for the...
They just land in a cove and then hop off into an emergency raft and then just start paddling underneath one of the cliffs.
Yeah, there's no obvious sign that there is a spot you should go. And it's not like the Skulls were very specific about this. They scorched the island on the map. Like, there's... could be anywhere on the island, but seemingly for the purposes of this movie, they know exactly where to go because otherwise it would be a much longer film. So they take the rafts inside. The Phantom goes into the water and it just sort of, I don't know, bobs up and down for a while and then gets into the cave after them. They arrive in the cave. Drax is like, "Oh, we're here finally." And it's like, Drax, who do you think lit all these torches in this cave and keeps them lit? Because it's not just like this for funsies, but he has this whole monologue before anybody comes out. And it's just like, no one realized that danger could possibly be lurking around the corner of a fully lit cave. But
the gang comes out and starts like harassing them and beating them up. And it's only like after tensions are high and they're like about to be killed, or they're like, "No, wait, look. I also have the same tattoo as you." Like, you could have led with that, probably.
Yeah, well, I mean, all of their interactions with these pirates are a series of escalations, which are, "I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. No, wait, I have this. No, wait, I have that." And, like, that goes on, that plays out for multiple scenes, because immediately after this, we have the scene with the mob boss guy, like, tries to get out for free, and then Remar tries to get out for free. And, like, it's just, like, you can't just keep doing that. You can't just keep, like, going, like, no, I have a secret thing you don't know about, which will keep you from killing me. But,
we're not so different, you and I.
Well, we are very different because you got all of your clothes from the Pirates of the Caribbean animatronic ride. But
so horrible. Like, they couldn't be more stereotypical Disney pirates if they tried.
No, really. Like the red and white striped shirts, the even the makeup,
bandanas tied around the head.
Yeah, the makeup they put on them to like make them look like greasy and grimy. It's like no one looks like that. Like that's not like. There's no way that you could physically get dirty in that manner. Like, it just doesn't happen. Like, that is just something where somebody has smeared grease paint all over your face. But they also seemingly have a weirdly ethnically diverse band of pirates. It just doesn't make any sense. But
they're an ancient order of pirates that are there to. Well, they kidnapped the one skull. I believe that was from the prologue of the movie, right?
Yeah.
Is their goal to get all of the skulls at some point, or are they just like just guarding the one?
No. When what's his name? Kari Hogawa. I think so. Kari.
Hang on, I'm locating.
Yeah, Kari Tagawa. Kari Hiroki. Harry. Wait, no. Hiroyuki Tagawa.
Good effort.
Sorry. He, a very recognizable character actor, very often assigned roles of Asian mystical whatever or thug things. He was Shang Tsung in the Mortal Kombat movie. He was on Nash Bridges. he's been in lots of things. Although weirdly, he's like apparently some born again Russian Orthodox Christian guy who has Russian citizenship now. So I don't know what's going on with that. That might be why you haven't seen him recently.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
You gotta find out what's up with you, Carrie.
Yeah. So anyway, it's weird to introduce a big bad at this point in your movie because they don't seem that big or that bad. But he's
got a sword.
Well, he's the one who reveals the information that there is a fourth skull. And
that controls the other three skulls, which turns out not what it actually does.
No, not at all. But what I think is funny is when he says it, unless you're like, I don't know, brain dead in the audience or have fallen asleep, you realize immediately who could possibly have the fourth skull inside of this cave right now?
Could it maybe be somebody who has been branding tiny skulls on everyone's face as they fight them?
It is a distinct possibility, Dan.
Also, do we ever see him brand a skull on anyone's face? Because I think James Remar ends up with a second face skull brand by the end of the movie.
I don't remember. I just remember that he starts off with one scar. And that was from the Patrick McGowan
Right,
one.
And he definitely ends with a second one. I did see that, unless that was literally just a like makeup malfunction and they accidentally gave him two.
Makeup malfunction on this show? No way. But, yeah, so they have their weird, like, no, I'll let you go if you do this. I'm not going to let you go. Oh, well, what if I do? Anyway, it just goes on forever. But what's interesting here is that when Chrissy Swanson and Catherine Zeta-Jones were in their car to the airport, and Chrissy Swanson had said, why do you have to be so mean? And, surely you have to care about something. And she's like what? And it's like, I don't know. You figure it out. And apparently that like really hit home for Catherine Zeta-Jones, because then when they get to this cave and, Chrissy Swanson's nearly sexually assaulted by one of the Pirates of the Caribbean cast members, she defends Chrissy Swanson, by kneeing the guy in the area, thou shalt
groin,
not knee. Yes. But,
the area thou shalt not.
She defends her and she says, us girls got to stick together. And it's like, where honestly, like show me on a map where that came from. Like there's no buildup to that moment. She starts off the movie hating her guts, punching her, smacking her, threatening to kill her, and then
fighting over a mysterious man that they've both literally just met.
Yeah, a super serious, weird catfight lust.
Don't try to deny it. You're in love with him, and he loves you, and I'm going to steal him. It's like, you both spent 30 seconds in a room with this guy.
Yes. Yes.
Don't do that, screenwriter.
No, it's really awful writing. And just the fact that they pivot so... disjointingly from that awful writing to a completely different avenue for awful writing of us girls gotta stick together is miraculous. But so anyway, Carrie's gonna maybe kind of kill them, sort of, kind of, maybe at some point. And then the mobster guy is like, nah, you're gonna let me go. There's no army coming. Like, I'm a mobster, see? And to see my pinstripe suit, my fedora.
Yeah, I love when he's in his suit and his fedora rowing that inflatable raft. Just like, dress for the environment you're heading to, buddy. You don't always have to wear your suit to let everyone know you're a mobster.
Yeah, like even in Weekend at Bernie's, like, what's his face dressed up for the part?
Yeah, Mr. Lomax had his little tracksuit that he wore at the beach.
Oh, I was talking about the mobster who went to go kill him.
Oh, well, you mean the guy who dressed up like a priest?
No, but he also had the other outfit, too. Anyway, he had outfits. But
yeah, well, he had, like, a pink t-shirt with, like, pushed-up sleeves.
Yes. Anyway, so what's weird here is he's threatening to shoot Carrie with the gun, except Carrie gives the order... to fire the cannon, and then explains in English that he's given the order to fire the cannon. So this guy with the gun trained on Carrie does not move to shoot Carrie and doesn't move to shoot the guy with a cannon, and instead stays perfectly still for the amount of time it takes for a cannon's like wick or whatever it is to burn down and fire the powder inside of the cannon and shoot a cannonball at him. Like, how do you could not write that, like, seriously, that someone gets shot with a cannon, like, on a delay like this. You could not film it like this, and yet they did. Like, how do you live with yourself, Simon? So that's what I want to know. Well, Simon Winsor.
The mobster is mostly talk and less action, and he's pointing the gun trying to convince the bad guys to leave him alone, but given that nobody is particularly holding the cannon, and once the cannon is lit, you can't really negotiate your way into, like, putting the cannon out, he's just temporarily befuddled, and then the cannon goes off and blasts him, like, ridiculously far out of the cave, which was kind of hilarious.
I mean, it was funny in effect when it had happened, and that he had stayed perfectly still for this to happen. These are not the kind of cannons that you get precision targeting on. But also, since they were shooting down from a second level to him, he would not have shot out into the cave.
Don't ruin his trajectory because it was comic gold.
Well, his trajectory wasn't real, Dan, in this movie with...
It was highly inaccurate, sir.
but then...
I have a question for the director. In the ending scene, the cannon was aiming downward at the mobster and hit him, but he flew up out of the cave. How do you explain that?
I like how you hate The Simpsons, but love comic book guy voice, but... The
wizard did it.
So they have...
Is that from Simpsons too?
Maybe.
Anytime you see a continuity error like that, a wizard did it.
Oh.
Might have been Futurama. I don't remember.
Could have been.
Don't correct me, internet.
But anyway, the Drax is like, oh, hey, don't shoot me with a cannon, because I have the Phantom's girlfriend. And this seems tenuous, but he offers up Christy Swanson, and... says, you know, I'll give you Christy Swanson if you give me the other skull. Carrie has already said that the skull is useless without the other skull to control its power. So I guess he's not that interested in it, I guess. But wants revenge on the Phantom, whom he has also said he can't kill. But whatever.
What do you suppose they do in that cave all day?
I don't want to think about it, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, everybody's so greasy that maybe it's a form of lubrication, but they they exchange Christy, and then the Phantom reveals himself and hops down and shoots people in the most hilarious ways. Like, he literally, like, does that thing where you cross your forearms and without looking fire on either direction, and somehow
he does it like 8 times. Like, normally they cross arms and fire and then like straighten back out, but he continues to fire with his arms crossed like 8 times, and then he's like, oh, I guess I can put my arms back the way they're supposed to go.
Yeah, and also it's so funny because he's not just like shooting aimlessly. He's somehow managing to precision hit swords and guns out of all of the pirates' hands. So everyone gets weapons knocked out of their hands as if this was a PG movie for small children where you couldn't actually shoot bad guys. but somehow he can do it by just crossing his arms. He does that, and then, you know, Christy Swanson swings down on a rope and knocks out a guy who has a sword, who apparently moves his sword out of the way of Christy Swanson so that he doesn't accidentally hurt her. It just adds to the hilarity of that. But they beat up the rest of the pirates, and then there's a big extended fight scene with Carrie, and he's defeated. And then James Remar and Drax and everybody, they all go to the sub room, and the Phantom decides that the only way for them to get out of this is to use the sub that the pirates have been using to attack boats that have been coming by, which is apparently why this is called the Devil's Vortex. That's a stretch. But they all hop into the they have Catherine Zeta-Jones and Christy Swanson hop into the little 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea boat ride
escape pod sub.
Yeah. And they're like, oh, it has live torpedoes. What if something goes wrong? It's like, this does not come up at all. Don't worry about it. So they get inside of there, and there's a clockwork steampunk thing that is going to fire them out of there, but he's got to pull the lever. Then he has his final fight with Remar, who he knocks into the wall. And then the presence of the other skull makes the other skulls turn into CG and fly up into the middle of the room and unite.
They spin up in the air and combine and twirl and then, like, settle back down into his hands.
Yeah, and for some reason Treat Williams is just like, what is he, laser cutting the metal wall? I don't understand what's going on.
Well, it's like he's taking a couple practice swings or something with his laser skull gun.
Yeah, and then James Remar calls for Treat Williams' attention, and he turns around and he shouts, what? And he accidentally zaps James Remar, and he turns into dust, and then the lasers turn off, which we don't really get an explanation of how this mechanism functions, but
maybe it's like the back skull facing him, you like put your fingers in the eyes or something.
Who knows? We'll never find out now, because this island is destroyed with skulls. But he uses the laser thingy, and he's gonna zap the Phantom, but the Phantom is dodging it, and he's like, you know, I've always known that this skull was for protection, but I didn't know from what. And then it's like, oh, good God.
So he shoots the three skull laser at him, and he just like puts his fist up and points his ring at that, and a blue laser comes out of his ring and purple. Catches the red laser. Purple.
Yeah.
Oh, of course it's purple. And then like the lasers are fighting, well, they both just sort of stand there.
Yeah.
And then eventually the purple laser overtakes the red laser and
it was yellow.
Explodes.
I see your Schwartz is as big as mine. But this really
he's carrying around these big clunky three skulls, and his laser isn't even as good as the little ring.
Yeah. No. See, it would have made more sense had he actually been able to use his ring to control some functionality of the other assemblage of skulls, but that's not
which is what we were given to understand was going to happen.
Yeah, from Carrie's dialogue like 10 minutes ago, 5 minutes ago, like it's stupid. Because what you basically get is like this back and forth tug of war thing that's all done after the fact. So there's just two actors grunting at each other across a set. And then Treat Williams explodes into a fireball, then this means the island is destroyed. So the Phantom hops off of The platform grabs the chain that was linked to the sub just in time because it's been ripped off, and then he's pulled out to sea, and he is with them on the sub while they all watch the matte painting of the island burn. For some reason, there's a cloud formation of the Sang pirate spiderweb logo thing. And then we go back to the Phantom's Lair, which is apparently an island off of Africa somewhere, which is, I don't know if you know this, on the other side of India, not even remotely near wherever they were supposed to be in Thailand. So they got out of there somehow. And he says his goodbyes to her inside the cave, and then, you know,
shows her all the gravestones on the wall of all of the phantoms that had come before him.
Yeah, and then he's all like, I can't reveal who I am except to the woman I will marry. Ugh, vomit. And
she's like, I know it's you, Kent.
And he takes off his mask, and he has no eye makeup around. And he confirms that it's him. And then she gets on her plane with her new buddy, Catherine Zeta-Jones, as they fly back to Manhattan on her seaplane, on her pirate seaplane thing that I guess she recovered from the first pirate thing. I don't know.
God,
it's so stupid.
Is that the end, or was there more? I don't remember.
No, there was nothing else. Because they didn't.
So she flies away.
Yeah.
So that's the promise that, like, there's going to be another movie where they get married and have baby phantoms.
Yes. Yeah. But don't worry, Dan. That is a Phantom Menace that you don't need to worry about.
Oof.
Yes. Quite. So this movie I had wanted to do because it's a disaster, and I feel like I have fully delivered to you the promise of it being a disaster.
It's really bad. it's really bad movie for 1996. We were better than this in 1996.
Were we?
I mean, some people were.
You sure about that?
Yeah.
You sure? You sure? Really sure?
I don't know.
Do you know what movie was in 1995, Dan?
What?
Congo.
Congo, yeah.
Yeah, so 1 year prior to this, you had Congo.
Just like Congo, they're trying to build a franchise without really putting a lot of serious investment in the first one, because they're like, well, we want to build a huge franchise off of this, but also, if it fails, we don't want to lose a ton of money, so let's kind of like half-ass it, just in case, and then they're, you know, the oh-no comic, because they didn't give it the resources it needed to succeed, and then it didn't succeed.
Yeah, well, this is a pretty classic failing of Hollywood when you have executives that see the success at another studio and try to performatively construct that success for themselves without understanding what makes that success work. So with Congo, you had executives who saw Jurassic Park and were like, we can do that. Let's just do the ape thing. And then they don't really figure out what's going on. But then with something like The Phantom, you have people who are like, yeah, so, you know, Batman, we can do that. And then you get this. Because this is well after the Tim Burton Batman era was already over. And you had your Joel Schumacher's. This is before Batman and Robin, but I think it's after.
So this was
Forever.
This was pre-Nipple Suits?
No, Nipple Suits were premiered in Forever.
And that was
the year?
Yeah.
I don't know. Batman Forever was 1995. Yep. Mid-90s.
Boy, as we're closing things up here, I decided to click on the trivia and goofs section of IMDb, and there's a lot of stuff here, as you might imagine. I'll just read you one. There are a lot of different headings too. There's the headings for anachronisms, continuity, crew and equipment visible, errors in geography, Let's see, Los Angeles palm trees can be seen reflected in the trunk of AJ's cab as he makes a U-turn in New York. My favorite is this one called Factual Errors here, this category. The float plane used to take Drax from New York to the Devil's Vortex somewhere in the Malaysia Peninsula is a Beechcraft Model 18. The range of this aircraft is 1,200 miles. The plane could not fly the approximately 10,000 miles without stopping to refuel. At which point the Phantom would most likely have been seen hanging onto the float by someone, even if the plane could have made the full flight nonstop with its top speed of 225 miles an hour. The Phantom would have had to hang onto the bottom of the pontoon for nearly 2 days.
Yes. This is what we were getting
so somebody,
back to.
Somebody literally did the math for that, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. This is
underneath that, a horse cannot gallop fast enough to overtake an airplane. Duh.
Yes, I believe we have said some similar things.
Hmm.
Anyway, I think it's a good sign for a movie if it has a lot of goofs. I like the crew reflection stuff because nobody, to be perfectly honest, nobody really cares about that stuff. Most of the time, the audience is watching this; they don't notice that there are palm trees reflected in cars.
Oh wow!
Or crew reflected when you do your close up of a car door opening or something like that.
It says reflected in the trunk lid of the cab. There's crew, but it also says at the end when the plane is flying away, the blades of the helicopter filming the plane are visible at the top of the screen. How did I miss that?
Yeah, well, you can see the blades of the helicopter that's filming the pelicans at the end of the Jurassic Park movie.
I think I remember that.
Yeah. Because you just couldn't do anything about that, so they didn't.
Zoom in,
and as you noticed from this past week of Todd Vaziri, Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Todd Vaziri, VES member, Todd Vaziri, he had posted that there is of course a crew guy just milling around in the back of one of the Star Wars shots from the original. Star Wars movie that's
not a crew guy, it's Obi-Wan.
It's not Obi-Wan because he's buckled in.
No, but it's from the footage later when he gets up, but they just moved it for continuity.
Oh, whatever.
He did a later thing where he cut those two scenes together because Todd re-edits things.
Does he now? Yeah. But yes.
Sometimes he slips and falls and changes the music on things.
That's a weird habit.
Yeah. Hopefully he doesn't hurt himself.
Should get different carpet or something. But, yeah.
Some shoes with some better tread.
Maybe some slippers for better traction in the home. Just go full on Mr. Rogers. Could you imagine Todd as like a Mr. Rogers with like an indoor cardigan, an outdoor cardigan?
I would love to see that. Hello, boys and girls. Today we're going to discuss the background crew members of Star Wars. Let's have a seat over here.
Hello.
It's a beautiful day in the galaxy. A beautiful day in the galaxy.
We're going to go to the land of make-believe, where I have added in the music from Dunkirk into this episode of Barney, the dinosaur. So,
can you boys and girls say Dagobah? I want to see Todd do a parody of Mr. Rogers.
Oh, that'd be interesting. That concludes our Phantom thoughts, our thread of Phantom thoughts.
Right as we approach an hour and 40 minutes, which is the duration of this movie.
Yeah. How do you like that?
Why? This is too much.
Mm-hmm.
This is more time than this movie deserved.
I think we had fun, though. And we discovered important facts like... that milk poster.
I'm totally buying one of these posters.
Oh god.
Actually, I couldn't do it. I don't think I could tolerate it being in my home.
Or on your credit history or your Amazon purchase history where they try to recommend things to you based on that.
Buy again and it's just Billy Zane's milk mustache.
Why am I getting all these images with white stuff over people's lips? But so
okay. All right.
And on that note, we are done.
Ugh.
Fly the plane into the sunset.
I have slumped down in my chair.